Jeffrey Toobin is writing a book about the election aftermath. He's a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also the author of bestsellers about the impeachment of President Clinton and the O.J. Simpson trial. He was among the first people to read the Supreme Court's decision last night. This morning, I asked him if he thought it was a clearly written decision.
Boy, it is among the most impenetrable legal documents of any kind that I've read, particularly for a Supreme Court opinion. You know, one of the things that all of us who follow the court closely and particularly follow the court's history is. You look for a certain level of grandeur, of rhetoric, of inspiration in the court's big cases. And it is shockingly absent in the majority opinion. In fact, there's a very interesting, the only sort of rhetorical touch comes at the very end. And it really is almost an apologetic note. And maybe I can just read a sentence
Please.
To you. It says, the court says, none are more conscious of the vital limits on judicial authority than are the members of this court, and none stand more in admiration of the Constitution's design to leave the selection of the president to the people through their legislatures and to the political sphere. When contending parties invoke the processes of the courts, however, it becomes our unsought responsibility to resolve the federal and constitutional issues the judicial system has been forced to confront. In other words, we didn't ask for this mess, but we're resolving it the best we can. And I think it's this concluding comment is a response to those, or at least it's an attempted response to those who say that that the Supreme Court got involved in this controversy when they really had no role in it. But it's really a rather pinched view, and the dissents, I think, recognize the moment, the importance of this decision, and speak in a tone more appropriate to it than the majority did.
Why don't you quote a couple of things from the dissent that you think are to the point and well-written? You complained that the majority decision wasn't very well-written.
Well, I think certainly the most evocative quote from any of these decisions comes from Justice Stevens at the conclusion of his dissent. And he writes, time will one day heal the wound to that confidence that will be inflicted by today's decision. He's talking about the confidence in the judicial system. One thing is certain, however. Although we may never know with complete certainty the identity of the winner of this year's presidential election, the identity of the loser is perfectly clear. It is the nation's confidence in the judge as an impartial guardian of the rule of law. And I think here what we have is Justice Stevens saying that if this election was not outright stolen by the United States Supreme Court, the Supreme Court really had an unseemly role in stopping the count and really just truncating the process when it was really not as broken as the Supreme Court said, as the Supreme Court majority said it was. And I think as we begin to sort of absorb this decision, I think the really shocking part of it to me is less yesterday's decision, but the stay that the court invoked on Saturday, because that was really the killer to this process.
In the sense that that's what let the clock run out. It was kind of like a catch 22 in a way. They stopped the process.
Yes, exactly. It's
and then said, "Well, it's too late."
Well, it's right. It's a little like the famous story about the man who killed his parents and then asked for mercy as an orphan. The majority says, well, the real problem was you didn't have any time to do this. And the reason they didn't have any time is because the Supreme Court stopped the process. I mean, it really was, that to me was really breathtaking. And I think that is where the dissents, make a very strong point.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her dissenting opinion, said, and this goes along with what you were just saying, time is short in part because of the court's entry of a stay on December 9th, several hours after an able circuit judge in Leon County had begun to superintend the recount process.
That's right. And in fact, and Justice Souter is even more direct. Justice Souter says, to recount these undervotes would be a tall order. But before this court stayed the effort to do that, the courts of Florida were ready to do their best to get that job done. There is no justification for denying the state the opportunity to try to count all disputed ballots now.
Jeffrey Toobin will be back in the second half of the show. He's writing a book on the election aftermath. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Toobin. We're talking about the Supreme Court decision ending the Florida recount. Toobin is a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's writing a book about the election aftermath and is the author of bestsellers about the Clinton impeachment and the O.J. Simpson trial. Jeff, experts were saying at the beginning of the election aftermath that the U.S. Supreme Court was very unlikely to hear any cases pertaining to the election because election law is traditionally state law, and the federal court would be very unlikely to interfere with state law or with state courts interpreting state law. The experts who said that were wrong. There were two Supreme Court decisions in the election aftermath. How has the Supreme Court explained its decision to twice get involved in the election?
Well, I certainly don't want to exempt myself from multiple failures during this, and I certainly was one of those so-called experts who thought the court would try not to stay involved. I guess the answer depends on how cynical you want to be. To take the Supreme Court on view on its face and to sort of read the words that the majorities have written, they felt that the situation was sufficiently chaotic and the issues were so great that the Supreme Court, as the ultimate arbiter of the law in the United States, simply couldn't dodge this issue and had to get involved. That's the non-cynical view. The cynical view is that, you know, these are politicians in robes, and a Republican majority on the court decided to bail out a Republican presidential candidate. You know, I think it's going to take a long time to sort out, which of those views or which combination of those views is correct. But it certainly was surprising to see a court whose touchstone over these past decade or so has been states' rights, particularly if you look at figures like Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice O'Connor, who have really made states' rights at the center of their jurisprudence. To jump in and essentially go into extraordinary detail about what Florida election law can and can't do, you know, it certainly raises questions.
What questions?
Well, it raises questions about what their motives were. Were they really trying to, sort this out in a way that was, consistent with the United States Constitution? Or were they trying to help a Republican candidate? I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, but I don't think their opinions answer those questions definitively.
Did any of the justices surprise you in the position that they took?
Well, I am somewhat surprised by Justice O'Connor. It's interesting. There are six opinions, and only Justices Scalia, Thomas, and O'Connor did not write individual opinions themselves. And although we don't know who wrote the majority opinion, it's called per curiam, which means for the court. And so it's not entirely clear who wrote that. But so six justices wrote, but O'Connor wasn't one of them. And she has made states' rights such a foundation of her judicial career. And remember, she's the only former state judge on the Supreme Court, the only former state legislator. So I am surprised she was not more sympathetic to the Gore argument.
Jeff, do you think that this Supreme Court decision sets a clear precedent? Do you have any clue how it might be used, how it might come into play in future elections?
One of the famous quotes, I think it's Oliver Wendell Holmes said, great cases make bad law. And I think the precedential value of this decision will generally be rather small, that there is just this situation is so anomalous and the opinion is so tailored to the facts of the case before it that I don't think this will set much of a precedent that will be useful in other cases. I mean, one of the ironies of this opinion is that this is a court that has generally been very reluctant to find violations of the Equal Protection Clause. In fact, one of the most famous cases that comes out of the sort of the recent conservative era in the Supreme Court actually comes out of Texas, where a group of sort of liberal lawyers said that in Texas it's they claimed it was unconstitutional for school districts to be funded at different levels in different counties of Texas. That, you know, in poor counties they only spend $3,000 per pupil per year, and in rich counties they spend $12,000 per pupil per county. The United States Supreme Court, in a famous decision called Rodriguez versus San Antonio, they said, no, that's fine. That's not a violation of equal protection. Counties are allowed to have a lot of discretion in how much money they spend. We don't, education is not a fundamental right like race or voting. And so, you know, unequal school funding is okay, but dimple chads are not okay. I mean, that is, you know, one of the curiosities of this opinion.
The Supreme Court was one of the issues in this campaign, in this presidential campaign, because the next president is likely to appoint a couple of Supreme Court justices. Tell me how you think the Supreme Court might change under a Bush presidency.
Well, you know, this gets very complicated because you're talking about a Senate that is 50-50 Democrats and Republicans. It is going to be next to impossible to get a conservative ideologue onto the Supreme Court through that Senate. When you consider there are 50 Democrats and a handful of Republicans, the two women from Maine, Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe, Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, who on judicial matters tend to vote with the Democrats, it's going to be very hard to get a conservative ideologue through. However, if you recall, the religious right, Pat Robertson, really had very few demands on George W. Bush, except when it came to Supreme Court nominations. That was the issue that the religious right cared about a great deal, and that's sort of what they really want out of George W. Bush. So it's going to be very hard to imagine how Supreme Court confirmation fights are going to turn out and who might be nominated in this extremely polarized environment, an environment that I think is only more poisonous regarding the Supreme Court because of yesterday's decision.
You know, I heard Nina Totenberg say on NPR that it's conceivable there'll be an empty chair or two for quite a while on the Supreme Court. Is that possible? I mean, is there a limit to how long the Supreme Court is allowed to function with an empty chair or two?
No, there's no limit. In fact, there have been periods when there's been an empty chair. Justice Douglas was sick for a long time in 1975 and refused to step down, and the court operated with eight members for nearly a year. I mean, it's not an ideal situation, and you have the situation of what's called decisions affirmed by an equally divided court, which is when the court splits 4-4 on issues. But it is worth remembering that, you know, both candidates, I think with an effort to invigorate their supporters, talked about how many vacancies there were definitely going to be in these 4 years. We don't know that for sure. I mean, Justice John Paul Stevens is the oldest member of the court, but he's only, and I say only by Supreme Court terms, you know, 81 years old, I believe. And justices have served into their 90s. All the rest of the members of the court, while O'Connor and Rehnquist are in their 70s, they both appear to be in good health. I mean, there is not an imminent vacancy on this court, and I think, you know, there's no guarantee there will be.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, a legal analyst for ABC News and staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's an ABC News legal analyst, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, author of a book on the O.J. Simpson trial, on the impeachment, and he's now writing a book on the election aftermath. Jeff, you wrote a book on the impeachment of President Clinton. I'm wondering if you see any similarities in the cast of characters in the post-election story and the impeachment story.
Well, I think one of the things I've been struck by in the just over these 5 weeks is that the intensity of feeling seems to be a lot stronger on the right than on the left. That the right wing in this country, and I don't mean that as a pejorative term at all. I mean Republicans generally have been so frustrated by Bill Clinton and so convinced of his illegitimacy as a political leader that they are mobilized and angry way more than the Democratic side. And I think that is true, even though neither of these candidates, Bush or Gore, personally excited that much loyalty or excitement. But the sort of anger you saw against Clinton has very much transferred over to this feeling, to this particular controversy about the election. So I think that's one parallel. I mean, another parallel, it may be obvious, but, you know, again, we see the legal system, you know, highly politicized. You know, with Clinton, it was a criminal investigation. Here it was vote counting. But, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we didn't have every political dispute wind up in court. Now it seems that we do.
So many of us were able to watch the various trials because of the Florida Sunshine Laws. Of course, we couldn't see the Supreme Court trial, but we could hear it. Were there any great lawyering moments that you want to single out?
There really were. I mean, being in Florida is like being in a different world. I mean, I remember, you know, I spent a lot of time in the Leon County Circuit Court, which is the trial court in Tallahassee, where Judge Terry Lewis dealt with the first sort of protest cases, and then the contest trial was held before Judge Sanders Sauls. And, you know, they don't just have one camera in the courtroom. They have cameras in the courtroom. You know, before court is in session, it's like a paparazzi scene in these courtrooms. And it was just, as someone who grew up in the federal courts and practiced in the federal courts, where, you know, you were barely allowed to bring a pen and pencil. I mean, I couldn't help but chuckle at these scenes that went on in these courtrooms. You know, as for, great lawyering, I don't think there was the sort of memorable oratory, in part because the issues were so narrow and peculiar. I mean, David Boies is a wonderful lawyer and did a wonderful job. But, you know, what he was talking about was the difference between a protest under Section 166 of the Florida Code versus a contest versus under Section 168 of the Florida Code. That is not the kind of subject that lends itself to poetry.
I think that both the judges and the lawyers had to take part in what you might call extreme justice. I mean like extreme sports where everything happens very quickly and is very daredevil. There was no time for anybody to there was no time for lawyers to prepare the kind of briefs that they're used to preparing, to do the kind of research. No time for the judges to take the time that they might normally take to decide such momentous decisions. Was that interesting for you to watch?
You know, as someone who practiced law, I had so much sympathy for the human beings involved, because one court after another would order at 5 o'clock that briefs would be due at noon the next day. And I knew that meant all-nighters for the people involved. And on both sides, I mean, the level of advocacy and the level of brief writing was so good. It was funny, you know, in the last Florida Supreme Court case, both parties kind of assumed that the briefs would be 65 pages, they'd be allowed 65 pages, and the briefs were due at noon. Well, at 9:30, the Florida Supreme Court said, no, we mean 50 pages, not 65 pages. So both sides madly had to cut their briefs in an hour from 65 to 50 pages. And what's really funny is that you can tell that in the table of both sides completely blew off the table of contents and just put random numbers in their table of contents because they just couldn't manage to get the software to work given the time involved. And that was the kind of thing that went on constantly and has been going on for the past 5 weeks.
Are there aspects of this story that you were following that you think have more or less gone unremarked that you'd like to talk with us about?
Elian Gonzalez is one of them. I think as we look back on this story, one of the undoubted turning points was, if you remember, the Florida Supreme Court ordered the recounts to go forward on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And it was supposed to go forward in Broward County, in Palm Beach County, in Miami-Dade County. The next day, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the Miami-Dade Canvassing Board, in a raucous scene, voted to end their manual recount, saying they couldn't make the deadline. And I think that moment is an enormous turning point in this whole case. And I think, I mean, this is obviously something I'm still looking into, but what a lot of the force behind the argument to stop the manual recount came from the Miami Cuban community, Cuban emigre community, that remains deeply outraged at the Clinton administration and the Democrats about the Elian Gonzalez case. And I think the decision by Miami-Dade and in why they decided to stop their hand count, something that was so crucial, I think that and is something that's going to take a lot of examination, for me anyway, over the next year.
So are you suggesting that that people in the Florida community, in the Cuban Florida community, put pressure on the canvassing board?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, I don't think it's inappropriate to put pressure. It was a political issue, but there is no doubt that the Cuban community was outraged about, you know, the Gonzalez case and about the plans for the recount. House Republicans made an enormous effort to send staff members down to Miami to assist in that effort. Absolutely, it was a highly politically charged environment, and you know, that effort turned out to be pivotal in how this race turned out.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, a legal analyst for ABC News and staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's an ABC News legal analyst and a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He wrote a book on the impeachment and on O.J. Simpson and is now writing a book on the election aftermath that's due to be published next fall. What are some of the questions that you feel really so far go unanswered that you want to investigate for your book? That you
well,
might
I've got one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Who won? I just don't know. One of the things that was so interesting about this recount process that started last weekend was that, of course, it was an enormous victory for Al Gore to get this recount started. But as even people in the Gore campaign would admit, it, privately if not publicly, is they didn't know, once you counted these ballots, whether they'd go ahead. I mean, that's a really serious question. That to me is sort of about the most exciting thing I could do as a journalist, as a historian. I mean, here we have a profound question about American history that is truly, truly unknown at this moment. Who won the vote in Florida? And, you know, it's amazing that we don't know that, but I think it's undoubted that we really just don't know who the answer to that question.
No, it seems to me that there are a lot of reporters and institutions that will be lining up to count those ballots. And as far as I know, those ballots can be counted because of Florida's sunshine laws, although I did hear somebody on TV saying that the Freedom of Information Act would prevent the ballots from being counted. So I don't know if there's any truth in that or not.
No, that's wrong. I mean, it's very clear under Florida law, as I understand it, that those ballots will be available to the public. People shouldn't get their hopes up for an overly definitive answer because, you know, as the Supreme Court struggled with this issue, how you count, merely having access to the ballots and counting them doesn't definitively answer the question of for whom they were cast, because you have to decide on the standard. You know, do dimpled Chads count? Do pregnant Chads count? I mean, that's hard to know.
What else do you want to know about what really happened?
Well, I really want to know what went on in Miami-Dade. I think that's a rich... I mean, everything about Miami is interesting, and why that count was canceled, and why... And the political passions that were roiling about it were fascinating. I mean, one of the things that I found interesting covering, you know, Florida for this Florida recount as long as I did, is that the counties sort of took on the personalities of human beings. You had, you know, the three counties, Broward, Palm Beach, and Miami-Dade, that did the recount. Broward was kind of the good student, the good child that was very organized and got and met the deadline, was very sort of meticulous and didn't really have all that many problems. Palm Beach was, you know, a fiasco from start to finish. You know, the kid who, you know, had his shirt tail out and couldn't get the work done and, you know, took Thanksgiving Day off and missed the deadline by 2 hours and they couldn't decide on a standard and they took 4 days off to fight in court. It was just a wreck. And Miami-Dade was kind of this mysterious, slightly sinister, not transparent institution that where we really don't know what went on.
Why do you think Palm Beach was such the bad student, the, you know, that took Thanksgiving off and missed the deadlines?
Well, I think you have to remember how this story started. On the day after the election day, we started hearing about the infamous butterfly ballot. And that was in Palm Beach, and where you know the names were not in the order that people expected, and the ballot was very hard to read, and there was the election supervisor there, a woman named Teresa Lepore, who was a Democrat and by all accounts a perfectly decent person, you know, found herself an object of vilification rarely seen in American life. You know, as it turned out, the butterfly ballot kind of faded as a legal issue because it's one of those things, well, what can you do about it? What remedy can you offer? There really is no, as the Florida Supreme Court ultimately found, there is no remedy for people who simply voted for the wrong candidate. But because the press focused on Palm Beach right away and Teresa Lepore was just completely intimidated by what went on, you know, there was sort of a crisis atmosphere from day one. Also, I mean, they just didn't have experienced people in all of this, and they just sort of didn't get it together. I mean, one of the things that, you know, as a lawyer, I learned about Florida that, you know, for example, states have personalities in legal settings. In California, everything moves very, very slowly. That's just how California law works. One thing you learn about Florida law is things happen late. Everything happens late. And to try to sort of get things done in Florida is very hard. And that, you know, manifested itself. I think the farther south you go, the more that was true.
Having written your book on impeachment, was it interesting to you to watch President Clinton, who had been the subject of so much partisan attention, to be silent on the issue of this contested election?
It was really amazing to see him such a peripheral figure. You know, I was down every once in a while, you know, wherever I was, usually, you know, working for ABC, they're always the all-news television stations, and, you know, it was constantly the same shots of the Florida Capitol and the Florida Supreme Court and Gore and Bush. And every once in a while, you know, Clinton's face would appear on TV and you'd go, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. And, you know, remember he went to Vietnam. That was supposed to be such a big deal.
Right.
It was going to be such a healing trip. It, you know, barely, you know, made the front page on any day. And, you know, I saw him yesterday. He was making this gives you some idea. On the day that, you know, all this tumultuous activity was taking place, Clinton was making some statement about the Federal Aviation Administration where he was saying, you know, gosh, next year I'm going to have to wait on all those long airport lines. I mean, you know, he's really left the scene. But I tell you, you know, one of the interesting things about presidents since World War II is they are at their least popular on the day they leave office, and they only rise in public estimation. It's true for every single president since World War II. Bill Clinton's pretty popular now. So, I mean, you know, maybe he really will run for mayor of New York. No, that's a joke. But I mean, he is. I think he's looking better and better.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so much for talking with us.
As always, very nice to talk to you, Terry.
Jeffrey Toobin is a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's writing a book about the election aftermath.